The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Today was day four of testimony in the first ever criminal trial of a former president. Trump's lawyers were able to finish cross-examining the prosecution's lead witness, tabloid publisher and longtime Trump insider David Pecker. We're going to talk about how that went in just a second. But today we got to see the prosecution's second witness, someone who has worked very closely with Donald Trump for decades, including on TV.
Hello.
Hi, good morning. This is Rona in Mr. Trump's office.
Good morning.
He'd like you to meet him at 8 a.m. at Toys R Us.
Hi, good morning. It's Rona.
Mr. Trump would like you to meet him at 9 a.m. at Tavern on the Green.
Good morning.
Good morning. It's Rona calling.
Hi, Rona.
Mr. Trump is meeting with Miss Universe at Trump Model Management.
He'd like you to be there in 2 hours.
Do you think he could be ready?
We can do it.
Thanks, Rona.
Okay. Bye.
Thanks, Rona. Rona Graff, Donald Trump's longtime executive assistant and occasional co-star on The Apprentice. The prosecution appears to have called Ms. Graff because she was the person who has handled Trump's calendar and contacts and his email, which Trump himself does not use. Ms. Graff appeared in court under a subpoena, and she testified that her legal bills were being paid for by the Trump Organization, even though she doesn't work there anymore. So while Rona Graff wasn't a hostile witness, it is a safe bet that she did not really want to be there. Now, the prosecution used Graff's testimony today to establish that Donald Trump had contact information for both Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal, the two women with whom Trump is alleged to have covered up affairs. And today they were able to show exhibits of Trump's old Microsoft contacts list, showing entries for both Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal, complete with phone numbers. Now, when Trump's lawyers got the chance to cross-examine Rona Graff, they didn't really rebut what the prosecution had established, namely that Donald Trump was in contact with Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal. Instead, the defense was quick to offer multiple reasons as to why Trump might have been in contact with the two women. Reasons, by the way, that had nothing to do with having an affair. For example, they asked Ms. Graff if Trump had been considering Stormy Daniels as a potential contestant on The Celebrity Apprentice, to which Graff replied, it was part of the office chatter. Now, it is worth remembering here, Donald Trump is not on trial for cheating on his wife. Trump's lawyers do not need to convince the jury that Trump was just friends or whatever with Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal, because having an affair with an adult film actress or a Playboy model is not illegal. But Donald Trump himself still publicly denies that those affairs took place, even though a majority of voters are not buying it and haven't been buying it for years. And since Trump is a famously difficult client who demands his lawyers defend whatever he says, those lawyers spent time in court today trying to convince everyone that these affairs did not happen. Which sort of gets at the bigger picture here, which is that Trump's attorneys seem to have a complicated task in front of them, to both manage their client and to mount a credible defense of the narrative presented by prosecutors. And so far, that strategy has not exactly been panning out. During their cross-examination of David Pecker today, Trump's lawyers tried to undermine the prosecution's star witness. They called into question Pecker's memory. They suggested that Pecker's tabloid, the National Enquirer, had its own business reasons for publishing negative stories about Trump's opponents and burying stories about Trump's alleged affairs. But all of that was undercut by the prosecution as soon as the prosecution got the chance to go back at Mr. Pecker. Here was one of David Pecker's final moments with prosecutors when he was questioned by the prosecution about why he bought and then killed Playboy playmate Karen McDougal's story about her alleged affair with Trump. Prosecutor Joshua Steinglass, had you published a story about a Playboy model having a year-long sexual affair while he was married with a presidential candidate, would that have sold magazines, do you think? Pecker, yes. Steinglass, that would be like National Enquirer Gold? Pecker. Yes. Steinglass. But at the time that you entered into that agreement, you had zero intention of publishing that story? Pecker. That's correct. Steinglass. And despite the fact that publishing that story would have helped your bottom line, you killed the story because it helped the candidate Donald Trump. Pecker. Yes. Pretty damaging testimony there. The defense team then tried to poke holes in it by suggesting that the National Enquirer killed the McDougal story not to help Donald Trump, but to help Karen McDougal. Defense attorney Emile Bovee. And you were very clear on cross-examination that Ms. McDougal did not want to publish that story, right? David Pecker. That is correct. Bovee. She wanted to promote her name and her brand, correct? Pecker, yes. Bovee. She, Karen McDougal, was a legitimate celebrity at that time, right? Pecker. Let me say this. Did she meet the celebrity category at that time? No. There were reportedly audible chuckles in the courtroom after that happened. It was not what you would call a highlight moment for the defense. In fact, to be honest, from my perspective, almost none of it so far has seemed all that great for Donald Trump. I mean, maybe you don't need a clear strategy and a compelling narrative when the job is simply to get jurors to believe in some kind of reasonable doubt. Or maybe this is what happens when you're working with an impossible client and kind of doing a bad job. What does a competent defense strategy look like in this trial? Well, as it turns out, I have just the people to ask. Joining me now, Andrew Weissman, former senior member of Robert Mueller's special counsel, and Anna Bauer, legal fellow and courts correspondent at Lawfare. A pleasure to have you both here on set. First of all, I am totally honest about being the layman in all of this. I will just say, Andrew, from what I have seen, I think, you know, anybody who's even casually watching this understands what the story the prosecution is trying to tell. It seems like a scattershot series of defense maneuvers on the other side, though. And I wonder from your perspective whether the asymmetry there matters.
It does. You know, what people say when they look at trials is you're looking for who has the better compelling narrative. And I don't mean that to denigrate defense counsel. I mean, they have an important job to do. And sometimes there isn't a compelling narrative. And what you are stuck with is sort of laying out a sort of variety of, you know, it's like a box of chocolates.
Yes.
Like, okay, the memory is bad. Okay, if you don't think the memory is bad, he's a liar.
Because or Karen McDougal's the one you wanted to catch right. and kill I mean, for.
Exactly. Or it didn't really matter because you would have done this all anyway. I mean, you sort of lay out a bunch of things. And sometimes you also are very theatrical. And so it's sort of by style, you sort of are saying, look over here, so that you sort of distract. But that's where somebody like Josh Steinglass, who's such an experienced trial lawyer. I mean, he sort of lives and breathes trials. He knows exactly what he's going to do on redirect. And a good prosecutor gets the jury back to, let's just focus on key things and come up with what's the best question to ask to get to the point. It's actually very similar to what you do, which is how do we, in a short amount of time, how are we trying to focus? And the sort of National Enquirer Gold is something that you're going to hear. That sort of, sometimes you consider certain answers jury lines that you are, that's like, that is something you are going to hear again. Because it just makes no sense that you would not publish the story
if it was
but
bold.
For having this agreement. And that narrative is one that if you're the defense, you kind of need to lean into that and say, okay, whatever happened here, maybe Stormy Daniels was different. But you have to, I think, to be totally credible, it's better to pick your battles.
Yeah, and you mentioned offhandedly, and it sounds like it didn't resonate that much, the attempt to undermine Pecker's credibility. Anna, you were in the overflow room. And I just wonder, for all of us who aren't really seeing this, it's hard to know how something lands. Can you talk more about that attempt on the part of the defense?
Right. So there were a lot of efforts today to undermine Pecker's credibility by, for example, looking at prior inconsistent statements that he's allegedly made. But they really didn't land because many of these so-called inconsistencies were in fact very marginal and immaterial. They were things that could be explained by the context. At one point, defense counsel tried to say, oh, in this FBI report in which the FBI had these notes, they wrote that you said one thing, but then you said at trial yesterday that you said another thing. And, you know, David Pecker really pushed back on that on the stand and said, well, you know, I'm not responsible for what the FBI wrote in their notes. I did not say that. And I know what I said. I know what happened. And it was the truth. And it really just was another moment in addition to, you know, the moments you just mentioned with the celebrity kind of comment where he pushed back on that, too, where things just weren't landing for defense counsel. Also, the cross-examination went on extremely long. It's the kind of thing where, you know, jurors, from what I have seen this week in court, I was in overflow today, but I've been in court watching the jurors. They've all been very attentive. But the way that things were going today, it's the kind of thing that a juror who is in for a long trial just doesn't appreciate, this focus on minor immaterial inconsistencies. It's something that kind of, you know,
you lose them.
Yeah, you lose them. Exactly.
I just Pecker as a witness overall, we talk so much about how central Michael Cohen was to all of this. But because David Pecker is involved in all of these, almost all of this, right, is talking with Michael Cohen and Donald Trump about this, is a very strong witness, at least to on the outside, it seems, on the stand. I just wonder, you know, how much he is really undergirded a very strong argument in advance of Michael Cohen's testimony.
So there are a couple things that are so great about him as a first witness. So first, you get the real sense that is principal and principal. David Pecker, Donald Trump. Michael Cohen is a staffer, to use that's Nicole Wallace's term, give her credit. I mean, he's not a principal in this. You have the National Enquirer and you have Donald Trump. They are making the decisions. And so that is important. And he tells you how it began, how it was carried out, and how it ended. He also gives you why it's a felony and also why you should care. And what I mean by why it's a felony, remember that this would be a misdemeanor if it's not to conceal or further some other crime.
Right.
And he tells you it's election fraud.
It's full
I mean,
on.
this is like he gives you that up one side and down the other. So the only piece that's really missing is the sort of false business records. And so the piece that you still need is that there obviously are false business records, but you need to have knowledge that Donald Trump knew that that would have to be part of the scheme. That shouldn't be that hard, because if you're trying to keep this secret, and David Pecker has already said he wanted to keep it secret even within the National Enquirer, he didn't want people to know about this. Why? Because it's a crime. And so you're not going to want to have a whole bunch of records saying, oh, this is the scheme.
The criming receipt.
Right. Exactly.
I do. You know, what is also so interesting is we're talking about Rona Graff, who's like, we played the early Apprentice tape. This is someone who's like Donald Trump's sidekick on The Apprentice. And David Pecker, who says he's still friends with Donald Trump. And I wonder, from a sort of the jury's perspective, how meaningful is it that two of his friends are taking the stand to offer not supportive evidence against him? And also, on his wife's birthday, the wife for whom he's lying and creating these elaborate scenarios, she's not there. None of the family's been in the courtroom.
Yeah, I think actually this is a really great point, because, and it's one of the things that I think made Pecker's testimony so powerful over the past week. Of course, the defense counsel has indicated that they're going to attack the credibility of Michael Cohen and of Stormy Daniels, and they are going to portray them as people who are biased and who are kind of out to get Trump. But with David Pecker, one of the last things that he testified to on direct is that actually he has very warm feelings towards Donald Trump. He called him a mentor figure who had helped him in his career. You could tell he had some real affection for him. And so this is a guy who is basically the kind of a key witness in setting out the scene and giving you the world of this scheme of hush money payments. And yet he is still sitting there telling you, like, I don't harbor any ill, you know, feelings towards Donald Trump. I'm just here to tell the truth. And that's what I think made him such a powerful starting witness.
I mean, with friends like these, Andrew, who needs enemies? It does bring me, though, to the gag order which we have not gotten a decision on. And I wonder what, I think the next hearing is going to be on May 2nd, which surprises, I think, everybody I've talked to. Is there a strategy behind this, do you think, on the part of Judge Merchan, or is this, he's just taking his time?
Well, you have to remember, he may be thinking this is sort of a sort of Damocles over Donald Trump. So he's got to be
is
thinking.
Is it though? I mean, well, he's still saying things.
He is, although, you know, you wonder how much. I mean, I do think he has a number of things that he can do in addition to fining him. Obviously, he could put him in jail, but I think no one thinks that will be the first step. One of the things that I've been advocating is, in addition to finding, you know, that he committed this contempt, is he can, with respect to, certainly with respect to texting and Truth Socials, he can turn to, let's say, Susan Nicholas, who is a responsible defense lawyer, mm-hmm. and say, you know what, you're in charge now. All of those things have to run through you. Essentially put a monitor in place, because that's really the harm, right? The harm is that he's saying this stuff, and essentially it's like there's going to be, you know, you have a babysitter now, and that's what's going to happen. Another idea, which is Neil Kochel's idea, is that he finds the contempt and says, I want you to know I am going to sentence you after the trial, and I'm going to see what happens between now and then. And also, then this
talk
is,
about a sword of Damocles.
Right. And then Ryan Goodman's idea is, and I want you to know, not only can I consider this in connection with contempt, but if you are convicted, I can consider all of this behavior when I sentence you.
Wow.
So these are all things that you can do to try and basically have him not harm the jurors and the witnesses.
This is far more creative than anything I had heard recently, Andrew Weissman.
It takes a village
to come up with the most punitive possibilities. Andrew Weissman, Anna Bauer, it's great to have you. Thank you so much for your wisdom and reporting on all of this. Really appreciate you on this Friday night. We have a lot more to get to this evening, including that moment 8 years ago, months before the election, when Donald Trump argued that he could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody without facing consequences. Do you remember that? I do. That argument is back, this time before the Supreme Court, and Donald Trump might be right. But first, I'm going to talk to Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter Ronan Farrow about what the surprising decision to overturn Harvey Weinstein's conviction in New York might portend for Trump's hush money trial in the same city. That's next.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. In fact, Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/podcastfree. All lowercase, shopify.com/podcastfree, shopify.com/podcastfree.
This is 8 days that we've all been sitting in this courthouse. This is all a Biden indictment. It's in order to try and win an election, political opponent, and nothing like this has ever happened. 8 days.
Today in New York County Court, former President Donald Trump stood for day eight of his hush money trial. And while we have focused a lot on the charges related to those clandestine sexual encounters, the day before, a different New York court upended a different case related to a well-known serial sex offender. That decision was made at the New York State Court of Appeals, where yesterday, former movie producer Harvey Weinstein had his 2020 conviction for sexual assault, the landmark case of the Me Too movement, overturned. The appeals court concluded that the original trial had allowed women who were not part of the case to testify about allegations for which Weinstein was not on trial. That ruling has now reopened a chapter in America's battle against sexual misconduct, And it also might have opened a window of opportunity for Donald Trump in his current hush money case, where prosecutors are also using allegations Trump is not charged for, allegations made by a woman, former Playboy model Karen McDougal, who is not part of the criminal case itself. Joining me now is Ronan Farrow, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter and contributing writer for The New Yorker. He is also, of course, the author of Catch 'em, Kill, Lies, Spies, and A Conspiracy to Protect Predators. Ronan, it's been a minute. It's great to see you.
It's a pleasure, Alex, always.
You have a piece in The New Yorker that gets at the strange sort of contradiction of this moment, right? But for, like, let's just unpack a little bit first. What is happening in the Weinstein case that, you know, 4 years after this conviction, in an appeals court, certain testimony is deemed not admissible and the charges or the convictions overturned?
So obviously part of the reaction to this is from an activist standpoint, from the standpoint of the many survivors who testified in this case and who were affected by Harvey Weinstein's alleged misconduct. There's anguish here, right? And there's a lot of concern about what it augurs for the future of sex crimes prosecutions, particularly in New York. But from a legal standpoint, close spectators of this case, I think, are less surprised. This was always a case that had this vulnerability where prosecutors were skirting a little bit on the edge of what was allowed under the New York rules of evidence, particularly this case law where there is a rule that says, by and large, you cannot let in evidence of uncharged acts. That's a general principle of fairness in criminal law.
But
New York is especially restrictive.
It's a little bit gray, though, too, right? I mean, does past behavior suggest current, present, or future behavior?
It's very gray, and it does vary a little bit by jurisdiction. The general principle is always there, but there are many, many exceptions. And in a lot of jurisdictions, there is an exception for sex crimes, where the assumption is these are often likely to be serial offenders who have an MO, so it goes to motive and intent. You can let in propensity evidence that says they raped before, so they might rape again. That's true in California, where Harvey Weinstein faces another guilty verdict and still has to serve 16 years. But in New York, you can't let in propensity evidence. It has to fall into these narrower categories where you say, as they're saying in the Trump case, for instance, we're showing you uncharged evidence because it establishes a conspiracy. These are all part of a shared
plot. We're showing you Karen McDougal's catch and kill
story. Or it shows you intent, or it identifies the people involved. Something more directly linked than here are multiple rapes.
It just seems so subjective. I mean, now you know more about the Weinstein case and the witnesses whose testimony they're saying should not have happened. When it comes to the Trump trial, I mean, do you think a reasonable inference would be that Karen McDougal's testimony should therefore be disqualified? Or is that, or is Judge Mershon operated with a certain, with enough caution here that this will not be overturned on appeal?
I think very much the latter. So the overturning of the Weinstein verdict is going to make every prosecutor in New York very, very conscious, as they always should be, but especially right now, about how fraught it is to let in this kind of evidence of uncharged acts. They're often called Molly New Witnesses, named after the case that established these rules and exceptions in New York. Now, in the Trump case, Judge Mershon has made a big show of careful jurisprudence. He's excluded certain things the prosecution has asked to let in. And in the cases where he's let broad swaths of evidence of acts that are not being charged into the courtroom, specifically the AMI transactions, he has said this is very directly necessary to establish a conspiracy, shared intent. You really can't fully understand what was happening with Michael Cohen paying off Stormy Daniels without understanding that Trump Tower meeting and the transaction to kill the doorman, love child rumor, and the transaction to kill Karen McDougal's account of the affair. It all ties together.
All right. So it's a smaller net that they cast, if you will, that directly touches all of the main sort of conspiracy.
On its face, it's a much more reasonable letting in of that kind of outside information.
I got to say, though, Ronan, I mean, given the magnitude of the Weinstein conviction, to have it overturned and now it falls back on the shoulders of A.G. Bragg, D.A. Bragg,
You have to retry the case.
To decide whether or not he wants to retry this case.
And he hasn't formally said that he is going to, but he has released a statement saying that he is going to do everything in his power to do so, which will make him a very busy man with a very busy office.
Well, I was going to say, talk about too high, because he didn't try the original. He was not in office at that point. And then there's, for everybody who's wondering, does this mean Harvey Weinstein is free? No, he's going to be sent back to California. Is that right? Where he will face
time for those convictions.
He may get sent to Rikers, for instance, first while they decide whether to retry him in New York. But yes, ultimately, he still has to serve out a 16-year sentence from a guilty verdict in California. And that verdict, I've been in touch with the DA's office in LA County, they're much more confident about, because California is one of these states where you can let in, as we discussed, propensity evidence much more easily.
Do you think, though, setting the legal aspect of it aside, I mean, how do you see all of this as it pertains to the picture of accountability for sexual predators, right? There's Donald Trump on trial right now for hush money. There's the E. Jean Carroll decision. There have been a number of ways in which it seems like someone with a complicated past and an unsavory and libel past as far as sexual assault is being held accountable. But then there's the Weinstein thing where it's really saying these women should not have spoken. And to survivors, I would imagine that is very difficult to swallow 4 years after such a hinge point in history.
Well, both of these cases lay bare the ways in which powerful people with a lot of money can manipulate the system. And one of the links between Trump and Weinstein is they were both using the National Enquirer and its parent company to manipulate things, to dig up dirt on opponents, to hide things they wanted hidden. Now, in terms of the future of sex crimes prosecutions, I think there is a lot of merit to the dissenters to this overturning of Weinstein's New York verdict. There's a particularly searing dissenting opinion that argues, hey, we need to be able to let in that kind of propensity evidence to some extent. It does go to intent. It does go to these valid reasons to let in uncharged evidence with sex crimes, which very often do fit a pattern and where you need to establish, hey, if someone is being trafficked, if someone is being assaulted, and you see other evidence of the alleged assailant doing the same thing again, that is relevant. They're not just isolated he said, she said cases. So I think that there is valid cause for activists around this to be concerned.
Well, it would seem that maybe New York should mirror what the federal government has in terms of its codes for what is allowed in.
Maybe this will trigger some discourse about that.
Well, we're starting here. Ronan Farrow, my friend, it's great to see you. Thanks so
Always.
Much for your time and
Thanks,
insanely,
Alex.
Insanely good reporting.
Busy week.
Yeah. Still ahead tonight, the Trumpification of the Supreme Court. Is the high court ready and willing to pick Trumpism over democracy? Professor Leah Littman joins me on that coming up next.
You can start your day off right when you find a professional on Angie to get your plumbing right first. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Visit Angie.com. You can do this when you Angie that.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. In fact, Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/podcastfree. All lowercase, shopify.com/podcastfree, shopify.com/podcastfree.
If there was any hope that Donald Trump's argument of absolute immunity would get a smackdown from the Supreme Court, that basically evaporated yesterday. Trump's defense argued that a president who calls for the assassination of his rivals or sells nuclear secrets to a foreign adversary may be considered acting officially and therefore immune from prosecution. Even a president who orders a coup could be immune from criminal prosecution. The court's conservative justices heard this defense and these bonkers hypotheticals, and not only entertained them, they appeared to embrace them. In his piece for The Atlantic, The Trumpification of the Supreme Court, Adam Serwer writes, Trump's legal argument is a path to dictatorship. That is not an exaggeration. The conservative justices have, over the years, seen harbingers of tyranny in union organizing, environmental regulations, civil rights laws, and universal health care plans. When confronted with a legal theory that establishes actual tyranny, they were simply intrigued. As long as Donald Trump is the standard bearer for the Republicans, every institution they control will contort itself in his image in an effort to protect him. Joining me now is Leah Littman, professor at the University of Michigan School of Law and one of the co-hosts of the great podcast, strict scrutiny. Leah, thank you for being here tonight. I thought Adam raised a really powerful idea insofar as the court has reacted so strongly to sort of tyrannical claims of liberal overreach on a number of issues. But when presented with actual tyrannical plans by a conservative, demurred from actually taking it up. What do you make of the argument he outlines there?
I think he is exactly right and really on to something. In some of the previous cases where President Joe Biden's executive policies were challenged, you had, for example, Justice Kavanaugh attempting to equate President Biden's forgiveness of student debt with President FDR's, you know, internment of Japanese American citizens during World War II, suggesting that was a gross abuse of executive power and executive overreach. In other challenges to student debt relief, you had Trump-appointed judges likening student debt relief to the laws that enabled the rise of Hitler. And then all of a sudden, when Donald Trump gets to the Supreme Court and argues that he can attempt to overthrow the government and not face any accountability for doing so, then they're willing to entertain it and debate this like this is just a normal legal question and entertain it and therefore allow Donald Trump to potentially run out the clock and delay potentially facing any consequences, again, for his alleged efforts to effectively overturn the results of a valid presidential election.
I also thought like the way in which they entertained it was really weird. I mean, it was almost like every time the details of the coup plot were brought up, they wanted to put on effectively blinders and say, but we're not here to talk about that. We're here to talk about like what this portends, what could happen in the future with future administrations. What do you think the reasoning behind that behavior was?
You know, it's difficult to know exactly, but you're right that Justices Alito, Justice Gorsuch, as well as Justice Kavanaugh relentlessly insisted on not discussing the actual facts of this case. I think because the actual facts of this case involve an attempt to interfere with a peaceful transition of power. And instead, they hypothesized random future presidents who might attempt to refuse to leave office in order to avoid the risk of criminal prosecution, even though they were faced right now in this very case with a former president who attempted to refuse to leave office and is now trying to escape the risk of criminal liability for doing so. And I think it was their effort to distract from the facts of this case, the fact that the events leading up to and including January 6th are a very real threat to our democracy and the rule of law. And instead, they attempted to abstract this case away from the facts so that they could distract us from the very real issues facing our democracy.
Or maybe the horror of what happened was too much for them to actually, you know, and entertain and rule on. I mean, I do wonder at the end of the day, Leah, if they remand this back to district court and it becomes part of a secondary legal proceeding and Judge Chutkan has to preside, what in the end is the point of taking up that? Why did the Supreme Court take this case up? I mean, the scuttlebutt at the outset of this was they're going to reject these presidential immunity claims, but they want to be on record because this is historic. If they're not rejecting the claims and they're just sending it back down, why take it up other than to shake Americans' confidence in the integrity of the court?
Well, I think the reason to take it up is potentially to delay the proceedings and delay the possibility of any trial until after the election and deprive the American public of the opportunity to send the question about whether Donald Trump violated federal criminal laws in the events leading up to and including the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol and whether that violated federal criminal law. And so they might end up rejecting Trump's most expansive notions of immunity and instead use this case to adopt some unclear legal standard that they are going to leave to the lower courts to apply and suggest that, well, maybe perhaps some of the activities involved, again, in this attempt to interfere with the peaceful transition of power, maybe those were official acts that are entitled to immunity.
I mean, just what you're saying, though, and I absolutely understand that a delay that would could potentially get Trump off of facing any accountability for January 6th and election interference, that would be an effect of this. But you're suggesting something really pernicious here, which is that the delay is actually intentional, that is something in the minds of potentially Thomas, Alito, and others. I mean, do you think that is how far this court has been adulterated, that we can say conservatives are not only considering politics here, they are behaving in an expressly political way for the gain of one party?
I don't think we can rule out that possibility. I think if you compare the court's treatment of the Trump immunity case to previous cases, it looks like they are doing things differently here and in ways that advantage Donald Trump. In the Trump disqualification case, for example, they decided to hear that case very quickly and schedule oral argument immediately and ensure a decision before the primary elections. Here, by contrast, they decided to take the case and then schedule it for argument almost 2 months after they decided to hear it. And it doesn't look like they are going to act in a similarly expeditious way when acting in an expeditious way is contrary to Donald Trump's interest. Or you compare the Trump immunity case to the case they heard before, which was the emergency medical abortion case. In that case, the Supreme Court elected to take the case before the U.S. Court of Appeals ever weighed in on it. But they declined to do so in the Trump immunity case, again, creating some additional delay, and that delay has the potential to allow Trump to run out the clock and prevent any trial before the election. So it does look like they are doing different things in this case than they have in other cases, all of which happens to benefit Donald Trump's attempt to regain power.
Wow, just a staggering corruption of justice. Leah Littman, it's so great to have you on the show. Thanks for being here tonight.
Thank you.
Coming up, amid the avalanche of Trump legal news this week, the Biden White House has been doing a bunch of things really, really, really right. We're going to tell you about some of the big ones coming up next.
American Airlines is refusing to give me my money back. I've called 4 times now, talked to 2 supervisors, sent 6 emails.
The wait was over 5 hours. I booked my own flight, thinking, surely they will refund me for this. Oh no, they're saying I did not give them the opportunity to reaccommodate me.
If you have flown on an airplane in the United States, you are likely well aware of just how frustrating of an experience it can be. And I'm not even talking about the legroom or those small square pretzels that nobody likes. This week, the Biden administration did something to address a very real problem when it comes to airlines.
We are coming out with a new rule that defines and lifts the standard for people getting their money back from airlines when the airline lets them down. One thing that's especially important about this is that you will automatically get a refund when you're entitled to one.
That was Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg announcing a new rule issued this week that when it takes effect in 6 months will mean if your flight is canceled, you will just get your money back. If you paid for Wi-Fi and it didn't work, you just get your money back. No vouchers, no talking to a million customer service representatives, no nonsense. This week, while the world watched Donald Trump sit on trial in his criminal hush money case in New York and listened to Trump's lawyers argue before the Supreme Court that presidents should be allowed to assassinate their rivals, all that was happening, the Biden White House was quietly rolling out major policies that will have a real impact on American lives. On Tuesday, Biden's Federal Trade Commission announced a new rule banning non-compete agreements. Those are agreements that bar employees from working for competing businesses. Now, when you hear the words non-compete, you probably imagine executives or scientists working on confidential proprietary stuff. But according to the FTC, 30 million American workers are bound by non-competes. Businesses essentially started using them to keep wages low. One of the most damning examples is in the fast food industry. Researchers estimate that 1 in 6 food prep workers have signed a non-compete, meaning you could be a fry cook making minimum wage at one burger place and be barred from applying to a job at the competing burger chain that opens across the street. But when this rule takes effect in about 3 months, that will no longer be the case. Then there is Biden's Department of Labor. This week, the Department of Labor finalized a rule that will make millions more Americans qualified to receive overtime pay. The old rules meant that if you made more than $35,568 a year, you no longer qualified for overtime. Thanks to this new rule, starting on July 1st, which is around the corner, that threshold gets bumped up to more than $43,000 a year. On January 1st, it gets bumped up again to more than $58,000 a year. That is going to mean a real raise for millions of American workers. And then yesterday, Biden's Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, voted to reinstate net neutrality, the regulations that ensure companies like Spectrum and Verizon can't use their power as internet providers to do uncompetitive things like slow down Netflix while keeping HBO streaming smoothly. The Biden administration did all of these things just this week. It's been a busy week. A More Perfect Union's Faz Shakir joins me to discuss what all of that means for Americans and for the next presidential election coming up.
Can I tell you a fantasy I had?
If sure.
I don't know if you're going to debate your opponent.
I am somewhere. I don't know when. Yeah. I'm happy to debate him.
Today, in a surprise interview with radio host Howard Stern, President Joe Biden said he would go to the mat and debate his opponent, the presumptive Republican nominee, Donald Trump. They're going to have a lot to discuss. Joining me now is Faz Shakir, founder and executive director of More Perfect Union and advisor to Senator Bernie Sanders and former campaign manager for Sanders' 2020 presidential run. Faz, there is no person I want to talk to about all this stuff more than you.
Happy Friday night, Alex.
Thank you. You too. The first thing is what the Biden administration has done this week in terms of, you know, just policies that are going to directly affect millions and millions of Americans. The net neutrality, the non-compete clauses being banned, new rules on airline refunds and junk fees. I mean, what stands out to you as particularly noteworthy and impactful?
Alex, I think we need to pull people back and say, what bonds all these together? You laid them out very cleanly. So I think it's like, what are the values undergirding this? What Biden is doing is transformational. But why is it transformational? So here's the problem. He saw that the economy was rigged. The great project of Biden is to unrig this economy. He says too much wealth, power, and privilege has dictated the choices in our economy. It has led to too much exploitation, too much cheating by few powerful actors. So what's the solution to it? More democracy, more economic democracy. That democracy takes a couple forms. It's workplace democracy, so I want more people organizing. I want more people being able to be free from non-competes. I want them to be able to, if they want to stay in the towns they live in, be able to grow up there. But I also want marketplace democracy. I want businesses to compete. When they compete, then we can make it in America. We can bring supply chains back home. We can build more businesses here. You take those elements together, that is the massive project that Joe Biden's engaged in right now. It's transformational. Not many people are talking about it, but I'm glad you and I are, because I think it matters a hell of a lot to millions and millions of people.
Yeah, it does matter a hell of a lot, and it is transformational. And you put it, you articulate it so beautifully when you, under the thesis of unrigging the economy. I got to say, the swing state polling that came out this week, right, in seven swing states, Biden is leading Trump in only one of them, the state of Michigan. This is among voters who say the economy is one of their top issues. How do you explain the disconnect between, you know, what the administration is doing and how voters feel about the economy and what this the priorities of this administration when it comes to economic matters?
These things that you and I were just talking about, net neutrality, non-compete rules, overtime pay, these are wildly popular if people know about them. In Washington, D.C., these are discussed. And do you know why they're discussed in Washington, D.C.? Because there are major special interests who hate them. Mm-hmm. The Chamber of Commerce, huge big businesses, they have an incredible amount of power to get their message out. And so what you often hear is either a dampening effect about, oh, the economy isn't going great because Joe Biden is taking us on. So you hear in, you know, a lot of corners of how business covers this stuff, not the effects of how they work in real people's lives. So what it means is those of us who have the power and platform to talk to regular people need to do a better job and make sure we're explaining it to people. But there aren't that many of them, because the way in which most people are consuming this is through big business.
Yeah.
And big business doesn't like this. So that's, we can't rely on the natural state of how media and the channels of how people get information to get people the information they need. That's why Biden is kind of left alone. He needs a lot of surrogates. He needs a lot of people who are his allies to understand what he's doing that's transformational and to go out there and talk to people directly about it.
I wonder, in a week like this where we've seen these college campus protests over the war in Gaza just absolutely ignite the flames of passion and indignation. There's been cries of anti-Semitism. There have been very, very strong words about what's happening to the Palestinian people. does that issue, I mean, I do wonder how, when you talk about this sort of transformational change around the economy, does just the high stakes of what's happening, for example, in Gaza, Trump, pardon the metaphor, whatever Biden is doing on the economy among young people whose votes are going to be critical for Biden this November?
Oh, there's no doubt. I mean, you're asking the question. You know the answer as well as I do, that it's certainly a dampening effect. Obviously, the president on this issue has to show policy changes in order to try to get people excited about voting for him and supporting him. I think, you know, if you get $20 billion as the Congress just approved for Joe Biden to have to give to Israel, I would hope that he would hold that and condition it and say, hey, you don't just get money until you change behavior. There's got to be some accountability by a Netanyahu government that kills, you know, 34,000 plus people. So I do think that that freedom that I see on campuses, that freedom of speech connects, by the way, to some of the things we're talking about. It is a left movement in this country that's advocating for democracy in a lot of different ways, including on campuses. So I see this as connected, but you're right that it challenges the media narratives of what is animating people's minds and discourse. What are the things that they're hearing? I hope they hear more about the economic transformations as well.
Come back anytime, Faz Shakir, one of my favorite people to talk about good news and bad news. Thank you again for your time tonight. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Alex.
That is our show for tonight.
You can live out your MasterChef dream when you find a professional on Angie to tackle your dream kitchen remodel. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Visit Angie.com. You can do this when you Angie that.